This is Artistic Director Martha Levy, and you're listening to the Steppenwolf Audio Program. Steppenwolf Theatre Company presents American Buffalo, written by David Mamet and directed by ensemble member Amy Morton, featuring Patrick Andrews, Francis Guinan, and Tracy Letts. American Buffalo, David Mamet's 1975 play set in Chicago, is the second production in our season of Belief. Amy Morton, our director, has long been interested in directing the play. Her history with Mamet's work includes her performance in our production of The Cryptogram and her direction of Steppenwolf's production of Glengarry Glen Ross. Like Mamet, Amy is deeply informed by the culture and voice of Chicago. The characters of his plays, their conversational rhythms, and the vocabulary of their expression are well known to her, lifelong Chicagoan that she is. Rereading American Buffalo through the prism of our season's theme, I was alert to how fundamentally the play turns on the question of belief. The play is a kind of Rashomon tale. Each of the characters has a different narrative for the events of the play, and as we receive the angle of vision of each, our perception of events shifts and turns. The central event of the play, the pursuit of the American Buffalo nickel, is resonant with meaning. Money is the great quest in the play, and the particular currency of that quest is an image of Americans' past, picturing, as it does, the Native American and a native animal made nearly extinct by the invasion of new Americans. Inscribed at the heart of the play is the story of America's history as a narrative of conquest, of invasion, of the coin of the realm. Donnie, Teach, and Bobby are American men of three generations. Donnie, owner of the junk shop in which the play is set, is the keeper of the past. The store is the repository for objects shed and forgotten. The youngest, Bobby, is gullible, dependent, sweet-natured, trusting. The middle generation, the man of the world, is Teach. He comes in from the outside. He activates the play with his ambitions and plans. He disrupts the pact between Donnie and Bobby. He takes over. Teach, his name is significant, comes into the play to instruct Donnie into the way things are. It's a costly education. Teach works his persuasion through insinuation. He disabuses Donnie of his innocence, insisting repeatedly on the difference between loyalty and business. All I mean, a guy can be too loyal, Don. Don't be dense on this. What are we saying here? Business. Ironically, it is Donnie who earlier in the play attempts to educate Bobby on survival, says, "There's business and there's friendship, Bobby. There are many things, and when you walk around, you hear a lot of things, and what you got to do is keep clear who your friends are, else the rest is garbage. Things are not always what they seem to be." This tension between loyalty and friendship and business is a central theme of the play. And what is the business in the play? Sales in a junk shop, betting in a card game, reselling the coins from the heist, the circulation of small sums among people who have very little and are scrambling for more. These guys will never be part of a larger economy. They are two-bit gamblers in hoods. They are men left out of the commerce of a larger world. All they have is friendship. What we witness in the play is the cost of valuing the commerce of which they will never be a part over the one thing they have, hidden in plain sight, their loyalty and friendship. Like the American Buffalo nickel, the value of their history and friendship is overlooked until it's gone. Mamet is telling the story of these men who represent three generations and so constitute a family structure, in the service of a larger story about America. By placing the American Buffalo at the center of the play as the object overlooked and then desired, Mamet is able to draw in the specter of our past and its extinction and the great overtaking power of money. The irony is that Mamet sets this within a social milieu of men who are outside of the real game, men who will never get beyond their financial circumstances and will, in fact, always suffer at the hands of society's real players. The question of value and values is acute in the play. This is where the play turns on the question of belief. When the nickel sat in Donnie's shop unnoticed, he was untroubled by it. He believed it was worth no more than its face value. Once he is alerted to the buyer's interest in the coin, he constructs an entire scenario about the buyer's intention, about the value of the coin, about how to retrieve it, along with what he imagines is an entire coin collection. He believes himself entitled to the coin, and he believes himself made prosperous by retrieving it. The old coin will be his passport to future wealth. I believe that Mamet is asking us to look at that transaction, the conversion of this old coin in image of America's past, into a new wealth made possible only by the heist, as an expression of values. What will we trade in for the acquisition of wealth? What becomes extinct in the quest for prosperity? The larger irony of the play is that these guys themselves are on the verge of extinction. In Mamet's characteristically irreverent way, he introduces the social forces rife in mid-1970s America that will dethrone the white man from the top of the social heap. Repeated reference is made to Grace and Ruthie, a lesbian couple who are better gamblers and more successful businesswomen than Teach. Ethnic slurs are invoked in the descriptions of people who have invaded what Teach considers his turf. The forces of feminism and multiculturalism are given presence in the play through these references and always as a threat to what Teach feels is his world. Today we find ourselves in an especially resonant cultural moment that can help us shed more light on Mamet's American Buffalo. The financial crisis has thrown into high relief the question of values and value. We are collectively questioning what we have paid for the American obsession with wealth, and we are witnessing the stratification of wealth, the winners and losers, when the game falls apart. American Buffalo has much to offer in the way of a cautionary tale, that it offers its wisdom in a story beautifully told and deeply felt is a testimony to Mamet's gift.
Director Amy Morton and Tracy Letts discuss American Buffalo with David New. I'm Gabe Levinson as David New.
I'm Tracy Allen as Amy Morton.
And I'm Tim McCarthy as Tracy Letts.
Amy, let's start with you talking a little bit about your history with David Mamet. When did you first become aware of his work?
I first became aware of him when I was taking acting classes at St. Nicholas Theater. He was sort of in residence there and teaching classes, not one of mine, and also giving writing workshops. That's where a lot of his stuff was first produced. I think I was about 18 or so when I first became aware of him, and so I've always been keenly interested in his work.
Did you see any of his plays when they were first produced in Chicago?
A number. Glengarry Glen Ross, Revenge of the Space Pandas, American Buffalo, Oleana, as well as the Remains Theater Ensemble's production of Buffalo and Speed the Plow.
And subsequently, you have acted in and directed his plays.
I acted in the Cryptogram here at Steppenwolf. The first time I ever worked on his stuff as a director was at Remains Theater Ensemble. As a company member, I accepted, and I don't know why, the job of putting in actor replacements for both Buffalo and Speed the Plow.
You hadn't directed the production, but you were putting in replacements?
Yeah, because the director was out of town. But then the first Mamet I fully directed was Glengarry Glen Ross at Steppenwolf.
Were you hooked from the start of working on his plays?
Yeah, I was very into his work right from the start.
And Tracy, had you acted in any Mamet plays prior to Glengarry at Steppenwolf?
Yeah, I had done a previous production of Glengarry, directed by Anna Shapiro at the Big Game Theater. I played the same part. I played Williamson. I think the first time I was ever aware of Mamet was the movie The Verdict. I think it was the first time I ever heard of him, because that's a great screenplay. One of my favorite Mamet speeches to this day is in the screenplay for that film. Perhaps only then did I start to read his plays, because, you know, growing up where I grew up, we didn't get a lot of Mamet. We didn't get a lot of access to that kind of thing. I think the first Mamet play I ever saw was Sexual Perversity in Chicago. It's a piece that was performed a lot by other groups because it was very easy to stage for young theater people. The first thing I did, though, was that production of Glengarry with Anna, and then I got a chance, of course, to do it again years later with Amy.
Amy, since you acted in The Cryptogram, I'll ask both of you questions from an actor's point of view. Much is always made about Mamet's language. Does it require a different approach in the rehearsal hall?
I would think, for me anyway, and I don't know if other actors and directors would agree, but for me, there's a technical requirement of memorizing those damn lines and being able to really rapid-fire the speech. I mean, it really goes fast. It goes really, really fast. And in my opinion, that's the way it's done the best.
And that requires that mastery, right?
Yeah. You really have to have those lines down, and that's what can drive you insane.
The trick for me is not just to be able to say it fast. It's also to be fully invested in whatever the circumstances are, and then say it fast. And then communicate all that at breakneck speed. That's hard to do. That's the trick, I think. Well, trick. I hate that word, trick. It's not a trick, it's a... What is it? It is what you do on any other play. It's just that the language demands a kind of clarity and alacrity. If you're just able to learn the lines and do it fast, then you are just doing it fast. And I've seen those productions, and those are deadly. You want to say, you're just talking fast, you don't really know what you're talking about or care about what you're saying.
Right, because there's an outward rhythm that belies the interiority of these people, right?
Yes.
And the actor has to mind what's inside, what the shifts are inside, all the time moving through with tremendous speed.
And you can say that about Shakespeare as easily as you can say it about Mamet. It's equally true in both cases, I think.
Amy, you've wanted to direct American Buffalo at Steppenwolf for a long time. What is it about the play that you find compelling?
I just think it's one of his best. I think it's moving and really funny. I think it's without cynicism, and I really like that because I think that his later works got cynical, and I don't mean that in a bad way. But this one to me feels naive almost, and therefore becomes, for me, even more moving.
Amy, the play was written and is set in 1975. Is it important to keep that particular period when you tell the story?
It is. Technically, strictly technically, there's a lot in there that places it in that time. When Teach says in Act Two, "And so who knows what time it is offhand, jerks on the radio, the phone broad?" Well, does that still exist anymore? Being able to call up and get the time? Also, it's like Glengarry. They're completely different plays if somebody pulls out a cell phone. You know what I mean? It doesn't work. I also really like the 70s for this. It makes sense to me. I can't wait to see Tracy in those stupid clothes.
You know, I didn't move to Chicago until 85. I've seen Chicago change a lot in 20 to 25 years. I can only imagine what those changes must have been like between 75 and 85. Chicago has such a rich history of crime and criminals and gangsters, but at the same time, Chicago was for a very long time, and still is to an extent, not just a city, but also a town. I think that's where some of the naive take that Amy is talking about comes from. They're not only in this great American city, but they're also in this Midwestern town. I get that vibe from the play from a time and place that I don't even really know, but that I can put myself in my imagination. Amy, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do know what you're talking about, and in a strange way, it's sort of the same flavor of Superior Donuts, in that it's a very neighborhood play. People talk about things that are in the neighborhood, restaurants, people, stores that you can tell they've known since forever and ever. That's really not the case anymore in Chicago. You don't get to know a place forever and ever because they don't last that long anymore.
Right. My point, better put, is what Amy just said.
There is very much a time and place, and I just can't picture this play in a different time. It doesn't gel for me.
It's also interesting that some of the articles in the shop, a number of them, are vestiges of Chicago's history.
Well, it's in that tradition of tough Chicago writing. That goes back to Nelson Algren and The Man with the Golden Arm and James T. Farrell and Studs Lonergan, which I think is even Studs Terkel's namesake. I think that is part of Chicago's literary tradition, a kind of bare-knuckles, tough, well, hell, even for that matter, the front page, which is also tough in its language, and fast. There's a kind of fast pattern to that language as well. So I think Mamet fits very squarely in that Chicago literary tradition. I think one question that a lot of people might ask is, why are you doing this again? It's been done, and it's been done again, and we know this material really well in Chicago. And yet, I've talked to so many people, younger people, who've never seen the play done. I guess to me, just thinking about that Chicago literary tradition also, some of these things that have a kind of modern classic status about them, for me, they become like Canterbury Tales, and they need to be told again and again and again. And the fun in retelling of them is, well, how are they going to tell this story as opposed to the last group told that story? Some time ago, I would have had a chip on my shoulder, actually, about doing this again. Why revisit when there are so many new stories that need to be told? But I think it has a real value, real currency, in that tradition of retelling our stories. This is also a very particular time for Chicago, in the history of Chicago and even Chicago theater. So I think it pays to revisit some of the shoulders of the storytellers we're building on.
Big Shoulders, Small Change, American Buffalo in Chicago, by artistic apprentice Rebecca Stevens. Open the script of American Buffalo, and you'll find the setting simply reads Don's Resale Shop, a junk shop. The shop's location in Chicago is never stated outright in the text, only inferred through the course of the play. A mention of Lakeshore Drive here, some leftover trinkets from Chicago events there, it all seems to add up to a little local flavor from Mamet, hailed by Chicago newspapers as the literary son of the city. At first glance, the setting of this play seems inconsequential. Even the Cambridge companion to Mamet readily places Don's Resale Shop on the south side of Chicago, without any indication from the text or author that this is correct. But place the geographic location Mamet mentions throughout the text, bars, hospitals, street names, on a map, and something startling happens. All of these public places are located within a few blocks of each other in the North Side neighborhood of Lincoln Park. To bring the action of the play even closer to home, consider this. Those city blocks are within walking distance of this very theater. Suddenly we know precisely where we are. We have walked the same streets and sidewalks as Donnie, Bobby, and Teach. The revelation that Mamet has set the action in a clearly defined neighborhood, rather than a hazy incarnation of Chicago, teaches us something about how to understand the play. What seems ornamental is imbued with specificity. And from that specificity, we may find a deeper understanding about the actions and intentions of our characters. It is worthwhile to turn our attention from the setting outside the junk shop to the setting of the junk shop itself and the objects the characters handle and discuss. A junk shop, after all, is a historical record made up of the objects of a certain place. Since the place in question is Chicago, it's little wonder that the objects in Donnie's shop relate directly to the city's history. When Donnie explains the significance of the cosmetic compact that Teach is holding by saying simply, "They're from 1933," Don asks, "From the thing?" Both men are talking about the 1933 Century of Progress Exposition, also known as the city's Second World Fair. Enacted in the midst of the Depression, the fair sought to restore confidence in science and industry, with nearly 24 corporations displaying new products meant to modernize the home. The fair spurred such great consumer spending that President Franklin Roosevelt asked for it to reopen another year to help stimulate the economy. Later, Teach holds up a strange object that Donnie describes as a thing that they stick in dead pigs. Keep their legs apart, all the blood runs out. This tool is undoubtedly left over from the meatpacking industry, the commercial stockyards so prevalent in Chicago that the poet Carl Sandburg famously dubbed the city "hog butcher for the world." Spurred by the growth of the railroads that allowed livestock to be delivered in mass quantity, Chicago's meatpacking industry centered around three enormous corporations nicknamed the Big Three Packers. These corporations influenced everything from railroad technology to meat and livestock prices. Their contentious labor laws and quality standards spurred both the infamous book The Jungle, detailing brutal stockyard conditions, and the deadly Haymarket Square riot as workers fought for the 8-hour workday. Even the pig iron, not seen in the shop but much discussed by the characters, belongs to a distinct Chicago moment. A pig iron, a piece of crude iron that creates steel when further processed, is a symbol of the steel and iron mills that once ruled Chicago's industry. In 1901, many of Chicago's largest mills combined to create U.S. Steel, the largest business enterprise in the world at its inception. These objects are leftovers from important economic moments in the city's history, periods in which big business and industry defined the values, pastimes, and futures of its inhabitants. What does it mean that Mamet sets American Buffalo within a very specific collection of Chicago streets inside a junk shop composed of objects from Chicago's great economic past? What does all of this have to do with three men trying to pull a heist surrounding a Buffalo nickel? To answer these questions, we must dig deeper into the context Mamet gives us. If our geographic setting is both specific and significant, then perhaps the time period lends us clues to the story as well. 1975, the year American Buffalo was performed, found the neighborhood of Lincoln Park in the throes of change. The aftermath of the Great Depression and World War II saw an increase of African Americans and Puerto Ricans in the area. By the mid-1950s, some residents, believing the neighborhood verged on becoming a slum, formed the Lincoln Park Conservation Association, encouraging private rehabilitation and use of federal urban renewal funds on buildings and homes in the area. In 1964, the city officially joined neighborhood efforts with its General Neighborhood Renewal Plan that rehabilitated some homes and cleared others for high-rises. Mamet's characters register these changes by referring to their Puerto Rican neighbors as Mexicans, or the Spics, and bristling at the wealthy white man who bicycles to work and treats Donnie like his fucking doorman. Donnie, Teach, and Bobby live in a neighborhood that has begun to change. Ethnically and culturally, they are no longer in familiar territory. Economically, they will shortly find themselves priced out of their homes. Lincoln Park's story is not unique to the city. Urban renewal funds from both the city and the federal government built the skyline of Chicago as we know it, including the Sears, now Willis Tower, and Hancock Building, both completed by the mid-1970s. These funds also sharply changed neighborhoods across the city as urban renewal projects altered the race, class, and geographical layout of many communities. Pilsen, named by its Eastern European inhabitants for a city in the Czech Republic, became a hub of Mexican-American life. Clearance projects in Hyde Park transformed densely packed urban areas into semi-suburban streets. And in Northside neighborhoods such as Lincoln Park, increasingly wealthy tenants moved into newly renovated homes as working-class residents moved out. Moreover, at the moment American Buffalo takes place, the economy fueling the city has begun to shift as well. Gone are the meatpackers as stockyards moved closer to its livestock in Wisconsin and Indiana. In just a few short years, the steel industry will crash as well, leaving thousands without work. With the loss of these industries, Chicago transforms from a blue-collar town of Polish and Irish immigrants to a white-collar town dominated by finance, tourism, and the service sector, while neighborhoods fill with new immigrants from around the world. What is happening to the men in this shop, in this neighborhood, in this city, is what is happening to the country itself. Industry begins to change. Blue-collar men find themselves among new immigrants and in new economies. The American dream is no longer familiar and certain. It shifts away from men who provide for their families with their hands, never to return. Just like the American buffalo depicted on the nickel that Donnie seeks and the Native American on the reverse of that coin, Donnie and Teach are at the end of their era, the last of their kind, as marginalized as the figures etched into metal. Unaware of this fate, they are left with nothing but the buffalo nickel they seek and the mistaken belief in who they are and what they can achieve. Designer's Notebook. Set designer Kevin DePinette on the creation of the American Buffalo set. Amy and I began with the idea of a small basement junk shop. A basement served our purposes twofold. It seemed to appropriately illustrate the social position of these men, either perceived or actual, and it allowed us to add visual interest by suggesting the structure of the entire building. I began the process by trying to stay as gritty and real as I could, and my earlier designs, like the one pictured, were appropriate in presenting a recognizable location. However, we felt the space needed to go beyond the walls and be a bit less prescribed. The set became a balancing act, not too big, not too small, not too clean, and not too dirty. I toured many resale shops throughout Chicago and found many that were trendy and clean, and a few that were downright shady. The balance of this junk shop was precarious. It could not indicate any sort of trendy appeal. However, it needed to be an open working shop, ready for customers. I wanted the place to feel dark, forgotten, and dusty, but not to the extent that this shop would be a necessarily dangerous place. I wanted it to feel more like a basement than a condemned building. The clumsy staircase entrance and the skeletal nature of the set contained these characters in the bowels of this building and the labyrinth of rooms and rows of merchandise. The requirements of the play are minimal, and the shop itself begs to feel cramped and small. The stage, however, is deceivingly large, and trying to fill a large space with small needs is challenging. The black portal that surrounds the set helps to focus and define the playing area and allows the space behind to fade into black. The set recedes into clarity and definition as it recedes in space, creating a sense of uncertainty. Did these men choose this way of life because of who they inherently are, or have their lives degraded because of their surroundings? Unfreezing the Play, by Director of Artistic Development, Polly Carl. Theater is a series of ongoing interpretations. The playwright, director, dramaturg, designers, and actors come together in a collaborative process seeking a multitude of possibilities for the presentation of a play. At some point, in order to bring in the audience, the play freezes, the script is finalized, the set is built, the sound and lights are programmed, and the actors find their rhythm. But the possible meanings of the play go on in post-show discussions, drinks after the play, and late-night pillow talk. My hope is to provide some heat to your conversations when you leave the theater, to thaw what we've temporarily frozen and invite you to collaborate in making meaning and theater with us. One of my secret shames is the PBS series Antiques Roadshow. I get obsessed not so much with the objects themselves, but rather with the relationship between people and what they value. When my family and I watch the show, we have a tradition of yelling, "Sell it!" whenever someone brings in an object that ends up being worth much more than they or we expect. When Teach says, "If I kept the stuff that I threw out, I would be a wealthy man today," I am reminded that American culture is predicated on the belief that as individuals, we're always on the verge of finding fortune. We might win the lottery. A priceless antique might be waiting for discovery amidst the cobwebs of our basements. My startup company will take off. By living in the land of opportunity, our lives will be fully actualized any minute now. The driving engine of American Buffalo is the worth of a Buffalo Head nickel. In For a Critique of the Political Economy of the Sign, author Jean Baudrillard argues that in an art auction, the relationship between the object purchased and the money exchanged for that object is skewed. The exchange supersedes the object's use value. In fact, the object may have no use at all. Baudrillard says the moment of expenditure presupposes something of a competition, a wager, an aristocratic measure of value. It is this, and not the satisfaction of needs that occasionally turns consumption into passion, a fascinating game, something other than functional economic behavior. Baudrillard makes a convincing case that the buyer at an auction establishes privilege, a kind of status, something beyond mere buying power. Although European aristocracy and Wall Street excess live in two very different historical contexts, I am fascinated by the idea of exchange as rooted in competition and passion. In American Buffalo, Don is obsessed with this nickel, with the possibility that he missed out on his opportunity for something more. Underlying the equally compelling themes of friendship and loyalty in the play, individual and communal worth is the play's thematic soul. The play's relevance to the contemporary crisis surrounding the question, "What's its worth?" can be overstated. Consider our national housing crisis. The value of homes had skyrocketed so high that buying a home 2 years ago wasn't unlike going to auction given the stiff competition and the inflated purchase prices. Home ownership conferred a new kind of ubiquitous legitimacy. Now, many of those new homeowners are stuck trying to sell for much less than they purchased, having been tricked into believing that entering the privileged class could be a steal at 0% down. At the end of American Buffalo, the plan for the heist falls to pieces, in part due to Bobby's lie at the beginning of the play. In the play, we never learn the actual value of the nickel. We know that a man paid $90 for it, and that Don is certain it's worth several times that. But the actual value doesn't matter. The nickel stands in for the value limit that Don, Teach, and Bobby can confer upon themselves within a milieu where the white working-class man is threatened by the rise of white-collar aristocrat. The man who, as Baudrillard says, I am suggesting now an equivalence between art lover and coin collector, does not create profit through his purchase but legitimacy. We never learn the value of the coin, but for Don, Teach, and Bobby, could it ever be worth more than what they can pay for it?